Chapter 18. Nadezhda Yakovlevna, Monday, the 2nd of May, 1938. As far as the state was concerned, our -12 banishment to Voronezh came to an end not quite 1 year ago, at 3:15 in the afternoon on the 16th of May, 1937, to be precise, when a pinched-faced Czechist with a waxed moustache, a client, as it turned out, of the charming prostitute who lived next door to us, signed and stamped an official document declaring that Mandelstam had served his sentence and we were free to live anywhere in Soviet Russia our hearts desired. There was an unstated catch. We needed to have a residence permit, and the only city in Soviet Russia we had a residence permit for was Voronezh. Which meant that for the poet Mandelstam, for his wedded wife, exile was expected to last a lifetime. Still, we were determined to move on. Where, how, only God knew. The first order of business was to get rid of the excess baggage we had accumulated since our arrival in Voronezh. Buckets, a chamber pot, a frying pan, a flat iron, a small one-burner kerosene stove, a kerosene lamp, a lumpy mattress, and an assortment of very mended blankets and quilts, a carton filled with chipped plates and saucepans. Some of the booty we bequeathed to our seamstress landlady. Some we gave to a couple of fresh-off-the-train exiles Mandelstam found wandering in Lenaya Street, desperately looking for a room to rent. Our landlady had decided we would be her last boarders, as she wanted to free up the room for her son. We packed our clothing into a valise and two satchels and a paper sack with a rope handle, and, paying the seamstress's son to assist us, made our way to the train station. With or without residence permits, we were drawn to Moscow like the proverbial moth to flame. Mandelstam, who slept fitfully and was despondent most of his waking hours, perked up the moment the train, heading north and west, pulled away from Voronezh. The closer we got to Moscow, the more animated he became. He wasn't composing verse these days, but it was almost as if his muse was breathing down his neck. I can tell you that Moscow, which we reached after a grueling 2.5-day trek, had changed since we'd lived there 3 years earlier. The long train crept through suburbs that hadn't existed before, wide dusty boulevards lined with brick apartment houses in various states of construction. The city itself looked as if it had had a facelift. Tsarist-era buildings had been steam-scrubbed, and you could catch glimpses of massive structures rising inside scaffolding, with imposing stone and steel and glass facades that, to my layman's eye, appeared inspired by what our newspapers called the decadent American ornamental style. The social climate had changed too, though I would be hard put to say it had changed for the better. For months, recent arrivals in Voronezh had been commenting on the existence in Moscow of a class of citizens they described as nouveau riche, to which Mandelstam, in one of his infrequent bursts of wit, had responded, "Better nouveau than never." Young people acted as if they had money to burn. Cadres were getting promoted rapidly, as those ahead of them in the pecking order were arrested. The latest cheek was to actually open a bank account. When I had money, like Akhmatova, I kept it pinned inside my undergarments. Apartments, dachas, used furniture, second-hand gramophones and records, even luxury items such as electric iceboxes, were said to be easier to come by, no doubt because so many people were vanishing into prisons or exile, abandoning their possessions behind them. The moment Mandelstam set foot back in Moscow, I could see that despite the danger of not having a residence permit, we had done the right thing to return. It may sound as if I am inventing this, but I could have sworn the colour of his skin changed from asphalt to, well, skin colour. An unmistakable gleam materialised in his eyes, almost as if the sights and noises of a metropolis had jogged a memory, had reminded him of life before death. He even walked at a pace that would have left a snail behind. Seeing a smile on my husband's lips for the first time in months brought a smile to my lips for the first time in months. Feeling like Jews who had reached the promised land after years of wandering a wilderness, we decided then and there that we absolutely had to find a way to remain in Moscow. The first imperative was to come up with a place to sleep. And so, flagging down one of the ministry pool automobiles, whose chauffeurs freelanced as taxi drivers, we headed for Herzenhaus in the hope of finding someone willing to put us up for a night or two. In the event, we had to make do with couch cushions on the linoleum floor of the tiny apartment belonging to one of the young poets to whom Mandelstam used to read his poetry. The poet's wife, a plump and pale editor at a monthly literary magazine, made it clear, as she set out the cushions on sheets of newspaper, that we were welcome to stay for 2 or 3 days, by which she meant that we were not welcome to stay longer. I didn't hold this against her. They were already running a risk having people without residence permits under their roof. Mandelstam, overcome with fatigue from the journey, not to mention melancholy at finding himself back in Moscow, stretched out on the cushions, and pulling down the ear flaps of his cap to block the clamour of traffic on Neshchokin Street, drifted into a deep sleep. I covered him with his yellow leather coat and lay down fully clothed beside him. I recall waking at sunrise that first morning in Moscow with a fierce headache. My husband was sleeping so soundly I didn't have the heart to rouse him. Making my way to the toilet, I rinsed my face and the back of my neck with rusty cold water from the tap. That made me feel human again. I decided to go downstairs and knock on the door of our old apartment. When I'd packed in a mad rush to accompany Mandelstam into exile, I'd left books behind, and I thought I might be able to recover them now. Which is how I came across the note pinned to the door of our flat. If anybody asks for Zakonski, I'm at the Dacha until the end of the month. There was also a telephone number. I didn't recognize the name Zakonski, but if he had a Dacha and a telephone, it meant he was published, which in itself was an inauspicious sign these days. The only writers published were the ones who towed the party line. I started to turn away when I remembered the latchkey I'd hidden behind the moulding near the communal telephone in case Mandelstam should forget his. To my amazement, it was still there after all these years. Nobody was stirring on the floor as I let myself into our apartment. The sight of the familiar walls, the sound of our old Swiss clock ticking away in the kitchen, brought tears to my eyes. The books I had left behind filled the top shelf of our old bookcase. First editions of Derzhavin, Yazykov, Zhukovsky, Buratinsky, Fate, Polanski, along with Mandelstam's beloved Italians, Vasari, Boccaccio, Vico. I gathered them up, and sinking onto the bedraggled sofa where Zinaida and I had sat listening to Mandelstam read his Kremlin Mountaineer epigram, began to leaf through the title pages. And naive as this may sound, it suddenly dawned on me. The best way to obtain a residence permit is to possess a residence. The explanation that came into my head seemed simple enough for even an apparatchik to understand. The poet Mandelstam and I had been allotted this flat in Herzenhaus. He'd been sent into -12 exile. I had accompanied him. Now, with exile behind us, we had returned to Moscow and wanted our residence back. You won't believe this. I barely believe it as I recount the episode. But my reasoning seemed so commonsensical to my twisted brain that I actually set off to find the district militia office. Imagine the fear I had to suppress simply walking through the front door. To my surprise, the officer on duty, an older man who from the look of him was desperately hoping to retire before they got around to arresting him, heard me out and then shrugged. You must understand that a shrug in Soviet Russia didn't mean no, it meant maybe. It meant I'm not senior enough to assume the responsibility of giving you a definitive answer. The officer suggested I try the central militia station on Petrovka. I walked all the way, hoping the exertion would calm my nerves and let my voice pass for tired instead of stressed. A long line had formed, and I had to queue for hours to reach the ranking militia official in the main hall of the Petrovka station. He was a baby-faced young man, too young for the post he held, which suggested that he had filled the shoes of an arrested official, wearing perfectly round steel-rimmed eyeglasses. He raised his eyes, but not his head, to peer over the rims at me. I started to explain our situation, but he cut me off.
"Impossible to be assigned a residence without a residence permit. Residence permit denied because you are a convicted person. Next!"
"I have no conviction," I cried. The woman behind me said in my ear, "Whatever it is you're after, dear lady, you stand a better chance of getting it if you calm yourself." I pulled the official document from my purse and flattened it on the desk so the official could read it. Again, he didn't move his head, only his eyes.
"It says here you are a convicted person," he said.
"I have no conviction. I voluntarily followed my husband into exile."
I might have been talking to an automaton. "It states here," he said impatiently, "Osip Mandelstam, convicted person."
"Osip Mandelstam is a man. I am a woman." I managed to snatch back my precious document an instant before he slammed his fist on the desk.
"Osip Mandelstam is your husband, isn't he? Under Soviet law, arrested persons and their families are deprived of residence rights in Moscow. Haven't you heard of Article 58? What your husband was guilty of, you are guilty of. I can charge you with anti-Soviet activities."
I am sorry to report, but I fled the Petrovka station in terror. After the failure of my pathetic attempt to get back our old flat, we lived like birds on a branch. We eventually settled into one room of a communal apartment in Kalinin, which was near enough to Moscow to come in by train several times a month. Word spread that Mandelstam had returned alive from exile, and friends flocked to see him when they learned, through word of mouth, that he was in town. Hoping to save us from a second arrest, my husband gave impassioned readings of his more recent ode to Stalin to anyone who would listen. We had no shortage of writers and poets offering us loans to tide us over.
"Tide us over what?" Mandelstam would ask in agitation when we were alone.
Among them was the self-described master of the genre of silence, Isaac Babel, who during one of our several visits to the rooms he rented on the second floor of a private villa glumly told us,
"Silence won't save me. Mark my words, they will come for me soon."
Quite a few close friends were willing to give us shelter in Moscow, though for their sake we never spent more than a few days in any one flat, lest our hosts be denounced to the police. Akhmatova dropped what she was doing and came to Moscow the instant she discovered we were back. Mandelstam and she flung themselves into each other's arms. Did I feel odd man out? No, I'm not offended by the question. They had never been lovers, though in a manner of speaking they were more intimate than lovers, by which I mean they were intimate in ways that lovemaking only scratches the surface of. There were occasions, I won't deny it, when this intimacy fetched up a lump to my throat that I identified as jealousy. They awakened the lost youth in one another. Employing a private language that by its very nature excluded others from the conversation, they could make each other laugh until one of them got a nosebleed. His hands behind his head, his fingers laced together at the back of his neck, Mandelstam strode the room declaiming poems from the Voronezh cycle. Anna Andreevna, in turn, recited the poem she had written after her visit to Voronezh the previous year, something about fear and a muse taking turns watching over a disgraced poet. As far as I know, this poem has never been published. We went to Petersburg once, which turned out, from my point of view, to be a mistake. Strolling streets familiar to him from his student days set my husband to trembling with emotion. We stayed overnight at Akhmatova's apartment, drinking toasts to poets and particular poems late into the night. At one point we could hear the telephone ringing in the corridor.
A neighbour stuck his head in the door. It's for you, Anna Andreevna.
She went to take the call, only to return a moment later looking quite pale. Who was it? I asked.
There was no one on the other end of the line.
We all exchanged looks. Mandelstam and I left in the morning. Anna Andreevna accompanied us to the station. I shall never forget my husband's last words to her. I am ready for death. On another occasion, we spent an afternoon with Pasternak at his dacha in Peredelkino, half an hour out from Moscow. Originally, the Kalichov estate, the village had become a fashionable retreat for fashionable writers in the late 1920s. We never did figure out how in the summer of 36, Boris, who was in and out of favour over the years, managed to get a foot in that door. It was not lost on any of us that his new, to us at least, wife remained in the kitchen during our visit to avoid my husband. Boris Leonidovich and Mandelstam pulled up stools next to the ornate tile stove for warmth. I remained on a sofa with a coverlet over my feet. Pasternak, who said he was in the very early stages of sketching the outline of a novel about us all, produced books he was reading on the subject of the French Revolution. I remember the discussion became animated, and I gestured to Boris Leonidovich to calm things down, for fear Mandelstam's pulse would start to race. Pasternak took the view that it was possible to survive a reign of terror, but my husband only shook his head in obstinate disagreement. "If you breathe the air of terror," he said, "you become infected. Everyone becomes a victim. Those whose heads are lopped off, the executioners who lop off heads, the masses in the streets who watch, even those who have the decency to look away." At the train station later, Pasternak, with the dexterity of a cutpurse, slipped money into Mandelstam's pocket when they embraced. We discovered it when I went to hang up my husband's yellow leather coat back in Kalinin. And so the weeks, the months, slipped past, with Mandelstam staring out of rain-stained windows in Kalinin or Moscow or Petersburg, repeating the names of people who had vanished into a gulag. If I close my eyes, I can reproduce his voice in my ear.
The enigmatic Kardjiev, with his oversized head, Hippolyte, with his wild scheme to seduce the Angel of Death, Zenya, with his nails bitten to the quick, Vardik, with his poems so convoluted even he couldn't understand them, Pasha, with his crazy theory about how Russia would be saved when opiate became the religion of the people.
I should say here, the disappearance that gave us the most pain, not to speak of the most anguish, was that of our friend and protector Nikolai Bukharin. We had, it goes without saying, followed his fate closely. His name as editor-in-chief had been removed from the masthead of Izvestia in the winter of 37, and we'd learned of his arrest soon after over the loudspeakers in the main streets of Voronezh. Mandelstam was particularly incensed to hear people cheering. For months on end there was no news of Bukharin. Then came his very public trial for high treason and plotting to assassinate Stalin. Ironically, Genrich Jagoda, the one-time head of the Cheka who had personally signed the charges against Mandelstam when he was arrested in 1934, was a co-defendant.
"We won't waste tears over him," was all my husband said when he heard about this.
The trial began early in March of this year in the October hall of the House of Trade Unions, where, we happened to know, Nikolai Ivanovich had proposed marriage to the young woman who later became his third wife. His confession, published in Pravda, was the principal subject of conversation in intellectual circles. Hitler's Anschluss of Austria was a close second, where Bukharin, despite his Bolshevik credentials, was considered to be a cultivated individual and a humanist. There were those who repeated the old saw, "Where there is smoke, expect to come across fire," which was another way of saying that, given the circumstances, the filthy little Bukharin, as he was described in newspaper articles,
would have been stupid not to have plotted against Stalin. There were others, we among them, who supposed that he had confessed to save his wife and young son. Esteemed Nikolai Ivanovich was taken to the vaulted basement of the Lubyanka and shot in the back of the head, if one believed the execution notice that turned up in the newspaper on the morning of March 15, which curiously was a few days after we bumped into V. Stavsky, the secretary-general of the Soviet Writers' Union. Let me explain. We had all but abandoned hope that we would ever get permission to live in Moscow. Abandoned hope of being able to survive the new wave of terror spreading across Russia. The last straw we clutched at was the possibility that in the absence of Bukharin, Stavsky would argue Mandelstam's case to Stalin. Would give him the text, which we knew to be circulating, of the Ode to Stalin. Stalin's eyes are parting mountains. But our desperate and repeated attempts to get an appointment with Stavsky failed miserably. We camped for hours on the hard benches in his waiting room. Secretaries would rush about. Eventually someone would take pity on us. The secretary-general was out of town, a woman would inform us. He was attending a conference of writers in the Crimea. He was visiting collective farms in various Soviet socialist republics, and so on. And then one day, implausible as this may sound, we stumbled across Stavsky emerging from the office building as we were going in. Or more accurately, he stumbled across us. We hadn't seen him in years, and I doubt either of us would have recognized him if he hadn't shouted, "Hey-ho, Mandelstam! I've been hunting everywhere for you!" Stavsky, looking very suntanned, wearing a coffee-coloured linen three-piece suit and dark glasses, hurried over to us and shook my husband's hand cordially. "I've been trying to get in touch with you," he exclaimed, "but nobody seems to know where you hang your hat these days." All Mandelstam, bless his heart, could think to say was, "I hang my hat in its usual place, which is on my head." Stavsky dropped my husband's hand. "Are you all right?"
"No."
"Ah, well, I have good news for you, Mandelstam. Your fortunes are about to take a turn for the better. To begin with, we have decided to give you and your wife vouchers for a 2-month cure at one of the writers' sanatoriums outside of Moscow. The stay will do you a world of good. Wholesome food, country air, plenty of sleep, long walks in the woods. You will be a new man. Then we will look into your rehabilitation. The question of a permit to live in Moscow, the matter of finding appropriate work for you, will be hashed out at the highest level." Stavsky instructed us to present ourselves at the Literary Fund office to collect the train tickets to Cherusti on the Murom line, and the vouchers for the rest home in Samartica, 25 kilometres from Cherusti. When we reached Cherusti, we would find a horse-drawn sleigh waiting to take us the rest of the way. Elation rose in Mandelstam like sap in a tree. "Pinch me," he said, when Stavsky saluted us from the back seat of his limousine as it pulled away from the curb. "I must be dreaming that this is happening." "The problem," I remember saying, "is to figure out what is happening." "But any idiot can see what is happening. My ode has reached Stalin's ears. Word has filtered back down that the poet Mandelstam must be looked after." He turned on me angrily. "Why aren't you capable of dealing with good news?"
"I am worried."
"About what?" "That there is no such thing as good news, only bad news disguised as good news. I am worried sick they want to get you away from your friends. I am worried sick you will be arrested again."
"What are our alternatives?"
"We can find an isolated house with ornamented shutters. We can grow potatoes and cabbages and cucumbers and beets and turnips in the garden. We can keep hens and a cow. We can exchange eggs and milk for loaves of bread and tins of roe."
Mandelstam's face flushed in agitation. "You don't fool me. You want me to publish poetry under the name Anonymous. Nadenka, don't you see it? They're going to rehabilitate me. My muse, perhaps even my erection, will take up residence again.
poems will begin to knock like a fist on the window. I shall make love and write poetry and publish under the name of Osip Mandelstam. Editors will beat down my door to get the rights to my collected works.
I looked into his eyes. He desperately wanted to believe we had turned a corner. I suppose I must have smiled because he said, "I knew you'd come around." I think I said, "What is there to lose by trying?" I think I thought, "Only what's left of our lives." "Why do you keep pressing me for details? There is only one detail that counts for me now. From the moment we ran into Stavsky, I had the sinking feeling of being on a steep and slippery slope."
"Yes, the train tickets and the vouchers were waiting for us at the Literary Fund office." "Yes, yes. There was a horse-drawn sleigh sitting outside the station at Cherusti, which Mandelstam took as a further indication that his fortunes had taken a turn for the better. Luxury of luxuries, an enormous sheepskin rug was folded on the seat. We spread it and tugged it up to our armpits, and the driver, an old mujik with knee-high lace-up leather boots and a wolfskin chapka on his pointed head, raised a whip to the horse, and we set out at a trot to cover the 25 kilometres to the rest home in Samartica. Winter had persisted into April. As far as the eye could see, the countryside was quilted with blindingly white fresh snow. Fir trees stooped under the weight of the ice on their branches. The sky was pearl blue, with wisps of clouds drifting at high altitudes. Swirls of frozen breath spewed from the horse's flaring nostrils. Mandelstam improvised a pair of peasant sunshades with his gloved fingers and took everything in, sighing from time to time at the splendour of the scenery. After 2 or so hours, the mujik pulled into the yard of a collective farm, and we were taken to a room where hot wine and biscuits were waiting on a table as if we were expected. Mandelstam kept glancing at me with a look of triumph on his face. We reached the writer's sanatorium at dusk. The resident doctor, an old Bolshevik who, he later told us, had taken the job in the rest home in the hope of lowering his profile, met us at the door. He confided that he had received a telegram from Moscow ordering him to treat the Mandelstams as important guests. The doctor looked honest enough. If we were being set up for arrest, I took heart from my gut feeling he didn't know about it. Mandelstam mentioned that he longed for quiet as well as peace. The doctor said there was a cabin at the edge of the woods that served as a reading room for residents. In no time they had set up 2 cots in the reading room and given us the key. We spread our clothing and books on one of the shabby sofas and lay down on the beds, fully dressed, our fingers laced under our heads. Lord knows why, but it was then that Mandelstam was suddenly overcome with doubts.
"You could be right," he said suddenly. "We may have fallen into a trap. If we are arrested here, Pasternak and Akhmatova would not hear about it for months." When my husband's spirits flagged, I must have felt a compulsion to be positive. How else can one explain that I said,
"No, no. Didn't the Literary Fund pay for transportation and the 2 month stay here? They wouldn't have done this if we were still living under a cloud."
"You really think so?"
"Yes."
Mandelstam cheered up.
"You are surely right," he said.
April went by. Hope put down roots in the thawing soil of Samartica. We went for long walks along the paths in the woods, slept late into the mornings, napped again in the afternoons with books from the shelves of the reading room open on our laps. I would come awake to find Mandelstam listening to music over earphones attached to a shortwave radio post in our cabin. We took our meals in the communal dining room not far from the main building. Occasionally writers or poets whom we knew or knew of came by the table to chat with Mandelstam. The wife of a short story writer, herself a translator, asked him what he was working on.
"Staying alive," he shot back.
"Everyone works on staying alive," her husband noted with a dry laugh. She meant artistically. "Are you writing these days?"
For some reason, the two of them brought out the orneriness in my husband.
"I never write," Mandelstam said innocently. "I compose poetry in my head and dictate it to Nadenka. She is the one who writes it down."
The writer's wife was obstinate. "And are you composing in your head here?" One of those ghostly wry smiles flitted across my husband's lips.
"Here, I concentrate on clearing the cobwebs from my head.
When we return to Moscow, when we are given back our flat in Herzenhaus, I shall begin composing poetry again."
"And then one evening..." "Thank you. Yes, I will start over." "And then one evening after dinner, peering from the window of the reading room at the edge of the woods, we watched as two identical black automobiles with white wall tires pulled up to the main house. The figures in the lead automobile remained inside. Two beefy men emerged from the second vehicle, one in civilian clothing, the other in some sort of uniform that I wasn't able to identify.
"Did you see that?"
Mandelstam asked in alarm. I could make out his eyes in the dying light. They were wide with fright. "They have probably come to inspect the rest home," I said. It was the 1st of May, 19 years to the day since our paths had crossed in that seedy Bohemian cabaret in Kiev. I say that with certainty, because I have a memory of the guests standing around a shortwave radio post in the late afternoon, listening to Stalin deliver a rambling speech. When an enormous gingerbread cake with 21 candles on it was brought to the head table after supper, people clapped their hands and stamped their feet on the floor. Mandelstam leaned close and told me they were applauding the chef who had baked it, not the 21 Bolshevik Maydays. After the meal, the guests gathered around a piano to drink brandy and sing Russian folk songs. For hours after we retired to our cabin, we could hear them singing patriotic songs at the top of their lungs. When I managed to fall asleep, I dreamed of icons, which is universally taken to be a bad omen. Death lurks behind icons. I remember sitting up suddenly, gasping for breath. My husband tried to calm me.
"We have nothing to be afraid of now," he said. "The worst is behind us."
At dawn, I was roused by the birds chirping in the trees around the reading room. I checked, as I always did upon awakening, to be sure Mandelstam was breathing. I heard someone knock. Pulling on a robe, I padded across the room in my bare feet and opened the door, thinking of the reproach I would make the guest come to borrow a book from the reading room at this ungodly hour. I found myself staring at the doctor, who was hyperventilating as if he had run the length of a soccer field. The two beefy men were behind him. The one in civilian clothing shouldered past the doctor.
"We are looking for Osip Mandelstam."
Mandelstam materialized behind me.
"I am the poet Mandelstam."
The two men pushed past me into the reading room.
"Osip Emilievich Mandelstam," the civilian announced, "you are under arrest for violation of Article 58 of the Soviet Constitution."
I seem to remember he showed Mandelstam the arrest warrant, though I'm not absolutely certain of this. My husband, who was in his underwear, nodded. He collected his thoughts, then went to the sofa and pulled on his grey trousers and a collarless white shirt, tucking it into the waistband and buttoning the top button against his neck. As the two men watched in silence, Mandelstam fitted on his suspenders and suit jacket and socks and shoes. He looked around to see what he'd forgotten, then climbed into his yellow leather coat, despite the relative warmness of the season. He retrieved the paper sack with the rope handle from under the cart and began to drop things into it. His one-volume Pushkin, edited by Tomaszewski,
some shirts that I had ironed the previous day, several changes of underwear and socks, the knitted winter scarf that an editor's wife had given him after his first arrest, a bar of soap, a comb, a tin of tooth powder, a toothbrush. I pulled my robe tight around my anaesthetized body and sat on the bed as if paralyzed. My husband came over to me. "Accompany me as far as Cherusti." The man wearing the uniform I couldn't identify said,
"That is not permitted."
Mandelstam leaned down and kissed me on the lips.
"Goodbye, then."
"Goodbye," I said. I looked over at the shafts of sunlight stabbing through the panes of the window. When I turned back, my husband was gone. I heard the motors of the cars spurting into life. The door of the reading room yawned open. The doctor stood on the threshold, his palm on his heart.
"I have no words," he said,
crushed by what had transpired. And he, too, fled, leaving the door open behind him. I could not identify the muscles in my body that would have allowed me to cross the room and close it. I cannot remember how long I remained sitting on the bed. It could have been hours. I do remember talking to myself. I remember trying to come to terms with my new identity by repeating it over and over. I am the widow of the poet Mandelstam. 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 I am the widow of the poet Mandelstam.
Chapter 19. Probably Osip Emilievich, mid or late September 1938. A copy of the following letter was generously given to the author in January of 1965, on the 25th anniversary of the death of Isaac Babel, who was tortured into confessing to espionage and shot, by Yekaterina Z., a woman living in Moscow who herself endured 3 years in a gulag and preferred to remain unidentified. She and her late husband, a critic who wrote his unpublished, later confiscated magnum opus on Russian poetry before the Bolshevik Revolution, were close friends of the Mandelstams, and, at some personal risk, put them up overnight on several occasions when Osip and Nadezhda were living like gypsies in Moscow, after their return from Voronezh. The letter arrived in an envelope fabricated out of coarse brown wrapping paper and postmarked from Ulaanbaatar, with the name and address of Yekaterina Z. printed in ink in large, majuscule letters on it. There was no return address. Undated, unsigned, except for the tantalizingly ambiguous, almost coded, still dancing at the end, the letter itself was painstakingly written out in pencil in a spidery handwriting, completely filling two sides of the title page and two sides of a blank page torn from a copy of Tomaszewski's Pushkin. It begins with the name Yekaterina Z., and her address in Moscow printed in a hand-drawn box. That's followed by the word Hope, which in the feminine singular is the name of Mandelstam's wife, Nadezhda. This, along with the several references to Nadenka, supports the supposition that the letter originated with Osip Mandelstam. If, as it appears, this document really can be attributed to Mandelstam, it was probably written in mid or late September of 1938 while he was en route to a transit camp in Siberia after his second arrest. It is reasonable to assume he mailed it in the traditional way prisoners posted letters, slipping it through the floor planks of a cattle car as the train carrying him east sped past a village or town at night. Hope. My second arrest, I keep track of them on the fingers of my left hand, I still have 3 arrests to go before I switch to my right, was extraordinary for being ordinary. I could sense the Czechists going through motions they had repeated, like workers on an assembly line, hundreds, perhaps thousands of times. They seemed bored to tears as they started back toward Moscow, 3 of them in the automobile with me, one of them racing ahead in the second vehicle to clear the road with his siren if it became clogged with trucks or cows. The Czechist in charge, the one who showed me the arrest warrant, actually offered me a tin cup with tea from a thermos. I was afraid to accept, lest the tea turn out to be poisoned, at which point he shrugged and drank it off himself. He didn't offer me a second cup. At Charusti we stopped at a military canteen for a lunch of illegible and black bread. I sat between the two soldiers almost as if I were a guest, and as I helped myself from the general bowl, I was able to eat. None of the soldiers at the other tables paid the slightest attention to me. When we started out again, I dozed most of the time in the back of the car, my head against my satchel, which was wedged between the back of the seat and the window. Approaching Moscow, I was awakened by the radio. Barely legible, could be crackling into life. A voice announced a change of plans. The Czechists were ordered to bring their prisoners to a militia station on the outskirts of the city. When I heard this, I started to shake uncontrollably. I thought they were going to take me down to the cellar and shoot me out of hand, which happened to me once before. We pulled up in front of the station. Trembling so badly I could barely walk, I was led inside, where an officer clearly senior to the others. Like you, Nadenka, I was never very skillful at identifying rank from the array of gold or silver on shoulder boards or collars, led me through the main hall and out a door into a courtyard. He directed me into the back seat of a shiny American Packard, parked at the foot of the steps, its motor running, an Uzbek soldier at the wheel. The officer took his place next to the driver and the Packard set off, thumping at high speed over the cobblestones of an avenue lined with brick apartment buildings, so new they didn't have glass in their windows. Can windows properly be described as windows if they don't reflect light? I felt as if I would suffocate, and started to turn down the car window, which is when I discovered that the glass was as thick as my thumb, which is to say it was of the bulletproof variety one reads about in newspapers. From this I surmised the vehicle belonged to someone important. For what seemed like minutes, though my sense of the passage of time had abandoned me along with my sense of color and my muse, the Packard sped along Government Highway. We passed a billboard depicting a Czechist wearing steel mittens, strangling a snake with the heads of Trotsky and Bukharin. I couldn't tell if it was an advertisement for a motion picture or propaganda. The Packard turned off Government Highway at a railroad crossing barrier, blocking a single-lane paved road that plunged into a wood. The officer in the front seat flashed a small badge through the windshield. The guard saluted and raised the barrier. We continued on for some minutes, then turned left into an even narrower road. Around a bend we were waved past a checkpoint manned by soldiers armed with submachine pistols. Some of the soldiers held watchdogs on short leashes. A high double chain-link fence trailed off on either side of the checkpoint as far as I could see, which wasn't far, because we were in the middle of a thick forest of black pines and white birches. Here comes the curious part, Nadenka. Around another bend, completely blocking the road, was an enormous full-length poster of Stalin. It was the size of one of those motion picture billboards, but standing on end, and showed Stalin with his feet slightly apart, his chin raised and staring off over the tops of the trees. He was wearing a plain military tunic buttoned to the neck and soft flannel trousers tucked into ankle-length boots. And to my utter befuddlement, the Packard didn't slow down but drove directly through the giant poster that was hanging across the road. "Dear Nadenka, I can almost make out your voice in my ear saying, 'Calm yourself, my darling. You're imagining things again.' To say the truth, I wasn't sure if this was really happening or I was fantasizing until I looked back through the narrow slit of a rear window and saw the ripped edges of the poster flapping in the currents created by our passage. Are you still there, Nadenka? I can't hear you listening." Familiar words resounded in my head, tearing the sackcloth canvas space, as we drove up an oval-shaped gravel driveway past the dog runs of a kennel, past a one-story barrack with Uzbeks in fatigues, sitting outside cleaning weapons on picnic tables. The Packard pulled up in the courtyard of a villa that was too big to be a dacha and too small to be a sanatorium, surrounded on three sides by closed-in glass porches. Uzbeks with submachine pistols at the ready surrounded the car. One of them pulled open the rear door. When I reached for my satchel, The officer in the front seat wagged a finger. "You will retrieve it afterward," he said. "After what?" I asked. "After illegible." Clutching my yellow leather coat around me, I climbed out of the Packard. A big man who looked vaguely familiar stepped forward and searched me thoroughly. He removed my yellow coat and flung it over the top of the open rear door. "If you're looking for a weapon, I don't have one," I said. "If I had one, I wouldn't know how to use it." To which he replied, "Clam up." When he'd finished patting down my trousers and my ankles, he stood up. "Don't you recognize me?" he asked. When I didn't reply, he said, "Vlasic, I'm the chief Kremlin bodyguard. Our paths crossed when you were brought in to see the boss several years ago." I asked, "Who is the head of household here?" He appeared surprised by my question. "Why, the Hossein, to use the Georgian expression, is the head of household, though the household in question sprawls from the Baltic to the Black Sea, from the Arctic ice cap to the Pacific Ocean." Motioning for me to follow, this Vlasic person turned on his heel and entered the building. Glancing back to be sure I was still behind, he walked slowly enough for me to keep up with him. We crossed rooms filled with heavy furniture. In one, a radio was playing classical music, and a woman was passing a carpet sweeper at the same time. "Ah, dearest Nadenka, here is a detail that will make you smile." There was no art on the walls, no paintings of generals such as I saw in the Kremlin, only pages torn from picture magazines, pastoral winter scenes, the Kremlin seen from various angles, that hideous tower in Kiev, a full-page aerial view in a Parisian publication of that marvelous Eiffel Tower. There were also quite a few photographs of film and theatre actresses. One looked amazingly like our friend Zinaida Zaitseva Antonova. I have sometimes wondered what became of the dear girl. Don't get the wrong idea, Nadenka. I don't miss the sex. I miss the intimacy that came from making love to her with you watching. For me, intimacy was always the ultimate orgasm. Turning down a long corridor, we reached a wooden door with what the French call a vasista over it. I could hear muffled voices behind it. Smiling faintly, Vlasic pulled open the door and stepped aside. I found myself at the entrance to a dining room with 8 or 10 men in it, some in dark European suits, 2 in uniforms with rows of medals on their chests and gold on their shoulder boards. I immediately recognized several of those present from photographs I had seen in newspapers. Kaganovich stood at a sideboard, heaping caviar and cream onto a blini in his plate. Molotov, with his distinctive mustache and sallow complexion and watchful eyes, looked up at me, then for some reason shook his head as if to dislodge a fly on the tip of his nose and went back to eating. Nikita Khrushchev, sucking noisily on a drumstick, wiped his chin on a shirt sleeve. Sitting one seat down from the head of the table was the Kozhein, Joseph Stalin. He added a finger of vodka to the wine already in his glass and sipped it. One of the men whom I didn't recognize, a short man with the pale greenish skin of an alcoholic and a pince-nez that flashed when it caught the light from the overhead chandelier, spotted me and said something in Georgian. Stalin looked up. "Here we speak only Russian, Lavrenty Pavlovich," he said with a scowl. He waved me in with his good arm. "Come on, don't hang back," he cried out. "Beria is not going to bite you." He pointed to a vacant seat across the table from him. "Help yourself to food, then we'll talk." I went to the sideboard and put some herring and pickled onions on a plate, filled a glass with mineral water, and made my way to the seat that had been indicated. Stalin himself had changed a great deal since I'd last seen him in the Kremlin. He had put on 10 kilos at least. A paunch swelled under his tunic. He was older and looked it, his hair thinner, the smallpox scars on his face redder. The hand of his crippled arm was tucked into the pocket of his tunic. He rocked back on the chair so that his weight was on its rear legs and inspected me. He noticed the stiffness of my shoulder and arm and asked me what had happened. I explained about having fallen from the second floor of a hospital and broken my shoulder. "Accidents happen," he observed, hiking his own bad shoulder. Stalin rocked his chair onto its 4 legs and, climbing to his feet, walked over to an enormous map of the world filling an entire wall of the dining room. Why is it towns around Leningrad still bear their original German names from the time of Catherine? He demanded. He turned toward one of the general officers. This is an intolerable situation. Change these to good Russian names. The officer pulled a small notepad from a pocket and jotted something in it. Stalin came across the room until he was standing behind me. Was I imagining that I could feel his breath on the back of my neck? I heard him say, "You disappoint me, Mandelstam. I have read your so-called ode. It is far worse than that first piece of shit you wrote about me. What do you think I am? An illiterate peasant? You still despise Stalin. You can't bring yourself to celebrate him. You drag him through the mud a second time." He circled around the head of the table and sank tiredly into his chair. "You don't eat," he said. "I have lost my appetite," I replied. He snickered through his nostrils. "And well you might." He turned to the others and shouted, "And well he might." Several of those around the table nodded in vigorous agreement. "There is a lesson here somewhere," Stalin rambled on. "I wanted a poem from him when he wouldn't write one. Now he has, but it's of no use to me because he is no longer the poet he was when he refused to write a poem for me." He continued speaking to the others, but his angry yellow eyes were fixed on me. "On the surface, this new ode pretends to venerate Stalin, but in subtle ways it is exactly the opposite." I think I mumbled, "I don't understand," because he grew more exasperated. "Of course you understand. You're the author of this piece of garbage. How could you not understand?" He turned toward his guests. "Out! Out! Everyone out! What I have to say is for the poet's ears only." The kittens, as Stalin was known to refer to his Kremlin associates, headed for the door. Khrushchev left, taking his dinner plate with him. Stalin snatched a piece of paper from his breast pocket and, his voice oozing sarcasm, began to rattle off my lines from my ode. "What does it mean? Stalin's eyes are parting mountains. This can only be understood as an echo of that treacherous reference in your first poem to Kremlin Mountaineer. What does it mean?" "I want to say, not Stalin, I want to name him Djugashvili. Why are you incapable of letting the name Stalin pass your lips, Mandelstam? Why Djugashvili, except to draw attention to Stalin's non-Russian origins? Who gives a shit if I have Georgian roots? Napoleon was Corsican, not French. Hitler is Austrian, not German. Even that prick Winston Churchill, who will slip a kopeck out of your pocket if you don't keep an eye on him, is half American. Believe me, Nadenka, when I say I attempted to defend myself." "You are misreading what I wrote," I began. But he rushed on before I could get a word in. "What does it mean? Artist, cherish the warrior. He is always with you. Are you intimating we live in a police state, with Stalin or his Czechist looking over your shoulder 24 hours a day?" He slapped the paper with the back of his hand. "And this, for God's sake, squirm out of this if you can." He smiles, a smiling reaper. Do you imagine for a split second that someone hearing this wouldn't understand the reference to Grim Reaper? Ha! And here, I didn't even notice this the first time I read your piece of shit. Bending from the podium, as if upon a mountain. There you go again with your fucking mountain. He reaches over mounds of heads. What does it mean, Mandelstam, this image you project of Stalin reaching over mounds of heads? It comes back again in the last stanza. In the distance where the mounds of human heads diminish. I see now I should have had you shot the first time you pulled off something like this. Out of the kindness of my heart, I gave you 3 years. The notation next to your name, in my own hand, read "Isolate and Preserve." And how do you repay me? With trash, with treason, with references to mounds of human heads in the distance. You might as well have erected a signboard pointing east saying, "This way to Stalin's gulag." My God, what insolence! His face went slack. His lips barely moved as he said, "You have played with fire, Mandelstam. You must be burned." Reaching into the big pocket of his tunic, he produced a spent bullet and a folded scrap of paper. He tossed the bullet across the table to me. I picked it up. The bullet was crushed, as if it had been fired into something. In minuscule, inked letters, it bore a name. Bukharin. "Yes. Yes. I can see it's dawning on you," Stalin ranted on.
This is the bullet that was used to execute the traitor Nikolai Bukharin. I had a surgeon dig it from his skull and clean away the brain matter. Your mentor, Bukharin, wrote, pleading with me to give him morphine so he could kill himself, rather than die with a bullet in the head, but I didn't dignify his letter with a reply. This note will also interest you. It was written by Bukharin moments before the sentence of the court was carried out. Fitting on a pair of spectacles, Stalin unfolded the paper and read from it. Koba, why do you need me to die? I whispered, why did you kill him? Again Stalin mixed vodka with wine and drank off half a glass. You forget where you are, Mandelstam. I didn't kill Bukharin. The Cheka discovered he was guilty of treason. The judges heard the evidence and sentenced him to the highest measure of punishment. The executioner killed him. Stalin had nothing to do with all that. The Kozyain belched into his sleeve. Bukharchik was an intellectual hunchback, he said. My late father used to say only the grave straightens a hunchback. I think I half rose from my seat. But he was innocent, I exclaimed. Stalin sneered. Innocent. Nobody is innocent. Let me tell you a story. I turned 11 the day two bandits were hanged on a riverbank in Gori. They were handsome young men with wide trousers and bristling mustaches. Dragging their leg irons in the dirt, they went to the gallows bantering with the constables who escorted them. One of the condemned men winked at me as they tightened the noose around his neck. When the bodies fell through the traps and danced at the end of the cords, two fat deputies hung from their feet to speed up strangulation. In a state of exultation, I ran all the way back to the shack with straw and mud caulking the walls to tell my saint of a mother I'd found out how to cheat death. You winked at it. You bantered with it. You didn't let on you were scared shitless to quit the only life there was, which, contrary to what the Orthodox priests preached, was the one before death. By chance, my father, Vissarion, who hired out to a shoe factory in Tiflis, had turned up that morning for his monthly visit, his breath reeking of cheap alcohol, an earthenware jug clutched to his chest. Crazy Besso, as his drinking pals called him, was a thick-set man with a scruffy beard. He was coming off an all-night binge, which is what he usually did when he had money in his pocket. Are you still there, Nadenka? Pay attention to every word I am about to tell you. Repeat it to no one. Let it go to the grave with you. Vissarion, Stalin ranted on, adding still more vodka to his wine, and drinking until the lids of his eyes turned crimson, set the jug on a shelf and pulled his wide leather belt out of the loops of his canvas trousers. I knew what was coming and cringed in a corner. What has So-So done now? My mother begged. She grabbed her drunken husband by the arm. Grunting, he spun around and punched her in the face. I could see blood spurting from her nose. My father loomed over me. Confess, he blurted out. Confess to what? I cried out. I am not guilty of misconduct. Vissarion cursed me and God the Father and Jesus the Son. Where is it written you have to be caught in the act to confess to misconduct? He told me. My mother pleaded with him. Why do you beat him if he is innocent? And my prick of a father said, I beat him to instruct him there is no such thing as innocence. He knows what he is guilty of, even if I don't. And he began lashing me across the arm that I'd thrown up to protect my head. This arm. Stalin raised his withered left arm. The more I protested my innocence, the harder he whipped me. He beat me until my shirt was in shreds, and my arm covered with welts and torn skin and sticky blood. Breathing hard, Stalin fell silent. I asked him if his father was still alive. He is burning in hell, he said. Biographies of me claim he died a hero's death. My saint of a mother once told me he drank himself into a potter's field. She didn't offer details. I never asked. Fuck him. After a while, I worked up the nerve to ask Stalin why he was telling me about his father. You won't like his response, Nadenka. He said, I tell you this because I'm talking to a dead man. Bukharin isn't around to save you a second time. Listen, there is going to be a war with Hitler. If I play my cards right, I may be able to delay it until 1942 or 43. I've drawn the appropriate conclusions from the Spanish Civil War, specifically from the Battle for Madrid, when the infamous fifth column of rebel sympathizers rose up inside the city to support the four columns of rebel troops attacking from outside. Before war with Germany breaks out, I must purify the party. I must weed out the weaklings and the doubters. The purging of 1 million members from the ranks of the Bolshevik Party, the several public trials, and the thousands of less public tribunals, the punishments that fit crimes which, given half a chance, the wreckers would commit, should be seen as a preemptive strike on the fifth column. I must eliminate the collaborators before they can rise up to support Hitler. My campaign against potential enemies must be guided by the principle that there is no such thing as innocence. It doesn't exist in this world. Every last one of the 150 million people in Russia, with the exception of my sainted mother, is guilty of something. Lenin tops the list. My own Nadezhda is high on it. All the old Bolsheviks, Kamenev, Zinoviev, Trotsky, and the others are on it. So is the darling of the party, Bukharin. So, too, the darling of poetry, Mandelstam.
Oh, Nadenka, my sharer of troubles. I tell you, I listened to Stalin as one listens to a madman. And then I remembered Tolstoy's tale of a man who, seen from a distance, seemed to be engaged in something which indicated he was mad. Coming closer, he realized the man was sharpening a knife. The Kozyaïn, it can be said, appeared mad, but he was sharpening a knife. I pushed my chair away from the table and... illegible. Stalin was talking to himself as I backed toward the door. His lips moved like those of an old man chewing cud. I heard him say, "The closer we come to success, the more active our enemy becomes. When he is at his most active and destructive, it should be taken as a sign that we are on the brink of victory." What transpired after that, dearest Nadenka, was anticlimax. I was taken to Lubyanka and signed in, but never seriously interrogated. It was as if my guilt had already been established. I was an enemy of the people, a wrecker, an agent of the discredited and executed Bukharin. The only thing remaining was to determine the appropriate punishment for my imaginary crimes. Talk about coincidence. For a time I shared a cell with Kristoforovich, the Czechist who interrogated me after my first arrest. You surely remember him, Nadenka, though you wouldn't have recognized him if you passed him in the street. He had grown cadaverous. His once fine uniform hung off his body. He'd lost most of his hair and all of his cockiness. He didn't make excuses for himself. He said only that his fall had been inevitable, in the sense that Czechists moved up the ladder by unmasking their immediate superior as a foreign agent, so it was only a matter of time before those below Kristoforovich denounced him. I asked him if he had confessed to crimes. He said confessions had been useful in 1934, inasmuch as accusations against an enemy of the people had required a certain plausibility. Nowadays, so he claimed, they concoct charges out of smoke. They don't hesitate accusing Jews of spying for Hitler, and confessions are considered superfluous, inasmuch as the organs are not required to establish a suspect's guilt. Rather, he or she must present proof of innocence. Kristoforovich was sentenced to 20 years of hard labor, without the right of correspondence. He, of all people, knew how to decode this, and taken off on a transport before me. I discovered he was gone when, returning one day from the toilet, I found the cell empty and a note from him saying, "You were my crowning interrogation. I don't understand why we didn't shoot you in 1934. I was eventually taken before a tribunal and, within minutes, sentenced to 5 years at hard labor for counter-revolutionary activities. Given my physical condition, I understood the verdict to be the equivalent of a death sentence. I was transferred to Butyrki prison, where convicts were assembled for transport to Siberia. On September the 9th, I and several hundred others were taken in closed trucks to a little-used freight siding outside of Moscow and herded onto cattle cars. I was told by a kindly guard we were being sent to the second river transit camp near Vladivostok in the Soviet Far East to await transport to one of the gulags on the Kamchatka Peninsula. I beg you, Nadenka, to send a package to Second River Transit Camp, with sweaters and gloves and soap. I kiss your eyes. I kiss the tears that spill from them, should this letter, by some miracle, reach you. Still dancing.